I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
All right, back by popular demand, we have a couple of our most popular guests. PGA Tour player Zach Blair and lawyer by day, phenomenal golf photographer by hobby, John Cavalier. You may know him as Lynx Gems. Gentlemen, welcome back.
How you guys doing?
Thanks so much, Andy. I feel like I should be getting strokes just by talking to you guys here.
I need some strokes if we ever played from Zach, for sure. You know, especially coming out of winter.
Yeah, well, we got to get out somewhere this year.
Yeah, well, you know, there's so many options. We'll get into all the options here and shortly, I'm sure. So tonight we're going to do things a little different. You know, we're just going to ask questions and let these two guys talk, considering they're playing all over the place, and you know, they've played everywhere. I'm just a novice in this threesome here. So both of you, well, Zach, you're right out there in the Monterey Peninsula right now, and John, you went out there recently. So, you know, let's just cut to the chase and talk about Cyprus. You know, Zach, you played there on Monday. Why don't you give us a lowdown about how it was?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is, you hear it all the time about how great it is and, you know, how spectacular that place is, and, you know, it kind of lives up to its reputation every time you get out there. It's, you know, pretty breathtaking. It's a really fun golf course. That's the best way I can describe it. It's extremely fun and sporty, and you got a bunch of wedges in there, and you can get to a couple of the par fives and bunch of really good par threes, and you know, it's just really enjoyable. It gets more fun each time you go out there. I've been lucky enough to play it a few times, so it's always a treat.
And John, you were out there last month. It looked like, you know, from the photos, you had an awesome day out there.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I played the same course or not that Zach played, because I don't remember reaching any of the par fives in two or having a bunch of wedges in, but I did play a course called Cypress Point while I was out there. And I will echo what Zach said. It's an amazing golf course. It's an amazing place. And it's one of those courses that it's just packed full of amazing moments. You know, like in golf, we chase these courses, and there are certain courses in certain places where you have these moments, like seeing the Alps hole at National Golf Links for the first time, or seeing the clubhouse and the 9th and 18th greens at Shinnecock, or the 9th at Yale, where you get this indelible memory. And at Cyprus, the thing that struck me the most was that it's just end-to-end, wall-to-wall, amazing moments. It's just an incredible place to have a golf course. It lived up to every bit of hype and expectation that I had, and then some. It's just an amazing place.
So, you know, everybody's seen the pictures. I've looked at them for countless hours. I'm curious, since both of you have been out there multiple times, what's the best part of the Cyprus experience that nobody knows about?
I mean, I just, you know, you always hear about 15, 16, 17 and how amazing those holes are. And, you know, those holes are amazing. They're unbelievable. But every other hole on that golf course is pretty unbelievable as well. So it kind of, you know, those holes 1 through 14, and they get overshadowed a little bit by those ocean holes. But, I mean, every hole on that course is so fun and entertaining, and, you know, you got so many different shots, and that you have to play, and different looks kind of going through the dunes and into the trees and then out of the trees into the dunes, and then you finally do get to those ocean holes. It's just like, it's amazing, but no one ever talks about any of those other holes, and they're pretty awesome.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. I was absolutely blown away with how good the quote other holes on the golf course are. I just, like Zach said, you hear about 15, 16, 17. Occasionally you hear some negative comments about 18, but you don't hear much about anything else. And somebody told me, who I talked to before I went out there, that when they had played it, the rest of the course was so good that they actually sort of forgot about the other holes. And when I was there, I found myself in the exact same boat. It's just so overwhelmingly stunning, and the quality of golf is just so good from the very first shot of the day that it's really hard to look ahead to anything beyond what's right in front of you. I mean, bottom line, you get holes like 8, 9, the two short par 4s, the 13th hole with the green backstop by the bunkers right next to the ocean. These are holes that are, you know, top 50 in the world, and no one ever talks about them. It's understandable, because 15 through 17 really are otherworldly. I mean, they are as good as it can possibly get in the world of golf. But I was just stunned by how good the rest of the course was. It's incredible.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, oh no, go ahead.
So I'm curious, with you guys both being McDonald and Rainer fans, and obviously the Rainer had routed the course and then he passed away and McKenzie kind of took over the project. How do you guys think the course would be had Rainer been there and infused template hole golf into the course?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually been, you know, I've talked about that before, and it's hard to say that it would have been better than it is, but I argue that I don't think it would have been any worse, because, I mean, that piece of property with how spectacular it is, you see what, you know, Rainer was able to do over at Fisher's Island. I mean, I think it would have been really good, but obviously, you know, McKenzie, with how magical he was with doing his bunkers and everything like that, it fit awesome out there. But I mean, I think it would have been really special if Rainer was able to do it, but you know, there's no knocking the way it is now.
Yeah, you'll never get me to admit that Rainer would not have been able to do as good of a job as any other architect with a given piece of property. As you guys both know, I think I'm just a Rainer fan to the extreme, so to speak. It's very interesting to think about the piece of property that Cypress sits on and where certain templates would go. I when I was standing on the 8th tee at Cypress, I found myself thinking that this would be a neat spot to build sort of an ounce punch bowl type of a hole if you extended it. There are a lot of neat possibilities in that regard. I've also played a lot more McRainer courses than McKenzie courses, and I'm sort of just now getting into the bigger parts of McKenzie's body of work. But I will say that McKenzie's style suits that location about as good as any style could suit a location. I mean, the way he does his bunkering, the way he routed the golf, or I guess Rainer routed most of the golf course, but the way he took advantage of that routing, the way he sort of ignored the usual way of spacing the par threes and the par fives out, I thought he did an incredible job. I do think, though, that Rainer would have done as incredible of a job as McKenzie did. I'll never admit that Rainer would be outdone by somebody else. I'm just too big a fan.
Interesting. So you guys have both played a ton in the Northern California area, and I'm curious to hear, you know, there's a dearth of great golf out there, how you'd rank the courses, say if you had to go 1 through 5 on the peninsula and including San Francisco.
Well, I've never played San Francisco Golf Club, unfortunately, but you know, I've heard it's great. But of the, you know, of the courses, and so are we talking like Cypress, Pebble, Monterey Peninsula, Spyglass, and San Francisco Golf Club.
Yeah, you could go San Francisco Golf Club, Cal Club, Olympic Club, Pasatiempo. All those are in play.
Man, I haven't played enough in San Francisco to really dive into that, you know, and I haven't even been out to Pasatiempo. But, I mean, as far, you know, I've played a lot out here. As far as the ones on the peninsula go, I mean, I give Cyprus, you know, the head over heels favorite for me. And then two would probably be Pebble Beach. I wish it had a little bit more of a rugged look to it like Cyprus has. I think it's a little too cleaned up and everything like that. But then the next for me would be the Shores course at Monterey Peninsula. I think that's one of the most unbelievable golf courses that no one ever talks about. You never hear anybody mention that place, and it's like one of the most visually most amazing places that I've ever played. You get so many of those holes right on the water. That would be right up there with Pebble for me. And then Spyglass.
So we're in large agreement, Zach. For me, Cyprus is by far and away the clear number one, and Pebble is by far and away the clear number two, despite a few flaws that I think you and I would both agree could be cleaned up. Although acknowledging that Pebble as a public resort course has some limitations that it has to sort of adhere to given its business model. Three for me would be San Francisco Golf Club, which is an incredible Tillinghast golf course, which you really have to see to believe. Zach, you got to get out there. You will absolutely adore it. Four, this is where it gets a little tough for me. Four, if I can sort of group them together, you'd be talking Monterey Peninsula for me, I believe. I would have a hard time deciding between Dunes and Shore. I love Strands. The Shore course is unbelievable. The Dunes course really pleasantly surprised me, and we can talk about that in detail if you want to, Andy. But for the five spot for me, it would be a really difficult call to make between Cal Club and Pasatiempo. Really like both of them. If you put a gun to my head, I'd go with Cal Club, but it's really close. I really liked both of those golf courses and happily play them at any time. There's just a lot of good golf between San Francisco and Monterey. And Meadow Club is another one that I'd consider to be just as worthy as those two. So I guess I gave you seven instead of five, but that would be my list.
Hey, the more
Yeah, Meadow Club's awesome.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about MPCC, which Alan Shipnuck called this week the best 36 holes of golf in America, best 36-hole golf club in America. So love to hear what you guys think and of that statement and kind of how it would stack up with Wingfoot, Baltus Rawl, you know, and other ones that you've played.
Well, yeah, I'll say this. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, Zach. I didn't mean to step on your toes there. I will say this. I liked it better than Wingfoot and Baltus Rawl. The scenery probably has a lot to do with that. And again, given that I am the rank hack of the group we have tonight, it also probably has a little bit to do with difficulty. I mean, I found Dunes and Shore to be much more playable to some extent than Wingfoot, but to a far extent, Baltus Rawl, which just crushes me. And I do know that it is it's sort of the goal of the club to be recognized in that grouping of the best 36-hole courses in the world. And I certainly think they're on the right path. I mean, the Dunes course, and after Zach gives you his impression, I'll tell you what I thought of the Dunes. But the two courses just, they're incredibly beautiful. They mesh so well together. It doesn't feel crowded or cramped at all. The property is spectacular. And just the ambiance of playing so many holes with the Pacific Ocean in view is an experience that you're just not going to be able to duplicate at other clubs around the country. It's really a one-of-a-kind experience for a 36-hole club.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I haven't been able to play the Dunes course yet, but I played with the Jackson Con guys that you know, were a major part in doing that out there. I was able to play with them at Scottsdale National last week and talked to them a lot about it. And, you know, went and walked around yesterday and today, saw the place, and I mean, visually, it's unbelievable. And I mean, just from the views, I mean, I don't know how you could beat that with any other 36-hole course that I know about in America. But I mean, like, I'm a huge fan of the Shores course. So if it's anything like the Shores course as far as playability and fun, I mean, that kind of takes the cake for me, because, you know, Wingfoot is great and Baltusrol, they're great, but they're, you know, they're championship major type tracks and venues. You know, they're ball busters. You're gonna go out there and they're gonna be tough from the first hole to the last. And you know, each course, Baltusrol and Wingfoot, you know, they got their course that doesn't host the majors, which I've heard both of them are really good. But I probably give the nod to Monterey just because of how fun they are and how playable they are for probably the everyday person.
Yeah, I think that's the shift in really architecture, and people are starting to realize that championship golf and difficulty aren't the, you know, really true definition of a great golf course. I think they have a part in, you know, determining certain courses' greatness, but definitely shouldn't be the defining factor. So, you know, Zach, you kind of parlayed perfectly into talking about, you know, Scottsdale National and Jackson and Conn. I'm curious what you thought about the Bad Little Nine, the little par three course that Bob Parsons built out there to be, you know, the hardest par three course in America.
I mean, I don't know if I can say enough good things about, you know, my experience out at Scottsdale National. Just, I mean, from the moment we got there till the moment we left, I mean, I seriously don't know if I've ever been to a club in my entire life that was as enjoyable and fun and inviting. And I mean, they just did everything that I could ever want at a club from the moment that I got out of my car till the moment I left. It was unbelievable. And then, you know, the golf was just kind of, it was awesome. I mean, that place is so cool. That little 9-hole par 3 course is unbelievable. I mean, it's definitely accomplished its goal of being the hardest par 3 course in the world, I bet. You can make that place as hard as you would ever want it to be. I guess on Fridays, they kind of set it up, you know, as hard as they can and give you a chance. If you break par or shoot even, they give you like $1,000 bar tab or something like that. So it's a pretty cool little game they get on Fridays, and I don't think anybody's even touched that, you know, going out there for the first time that day. But I mean, it's so cool. And at the same time, they can set it up as easy as they want it too. There's a lot, the greens are massive for the most part, and there's a lot of undulation and slope, and they can put pins in really easy spots and make it really fun for anybody of any skill level, I guess. But I mean, it's so cool. Visually, it's awesome. They did a really good job out there, and I was able to see, you know, some of the other work they did out on the other course, which is, you know, looks like it's pretty tough and pretty good as well. So I really enjoyed it.
You know, I got a lot of crap. I wrote in my newsletter that Phoenix and Scottsdale was a below average golf town, and I got shellacked by people. And I'd love to hear your guys' two takes on the subject matter.
Yeah, take it away, John.
Well, I haven't played a lot of golf in the Phoenix and Scottsdale area, and so my response to you would be, I think it's reasonable to assume that there is a reason that I haven't played a whole lot of golf in the Phoenix and Scottsdale area. I am not normally a big fan of desert golf. Visually, as far as playability goes, it just isn't a style of golf that appeals to me. By definition, desert golf can't really be minimalist, which I tend to gravitate toward that kind of a style. Everything is manufactured, and it's very difficult, I've found, for architects, and especially since a lot of those courses were built during the same time period, when a lot of architects weren't even paying attention to that kind of thing. What you end up with is a lot of courses that don't really fit into my typical preferred style of play, so to speak. But I've been there once. I played half a dozen, seven, eight courses out that way. I liked a couple of them, didn't like a couple others. Again, I don't like to criticize an area or a specific golf course too harshly, but it's just not an area that is my cup of tea, so to speak. There are, in the list of places in the United States that I would rather take a golf trip to, there are probably 30 or 40 locales that would be on that list ahead of the Scottsdale area. They got great weather in the winter, though, so, I mean, they shouldn't be too upset.
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest way to put that is, like John just said, I think there's so many areas that are head over heels better that have such a bigger group of great golf courses that it's hard to head to Phoenix just for the weather or just for, you know, the handful of good golf courses when you could, you know, pick 30 other places in America that have way more courses that are really, really good, and the weather is probably just as good.
Yeah,
well,
that's my whole point was quantity doesn't equal quality. So you know, speaking of, we were just talking about nine hole courses. I'd love to hear some of your guys' favorite nine hole courses that you've played.
Yeah, I mean, that bad little nine was as cool as you get from a little par three perspective. But one of my favorite courses, I think, in the entire world is Kahuku Golf Club, or golf course, whatever, out in on the North Shore in Hawaii. It's not always in the best shape, but, I mean, man, it's on the coolest piece of property, and it's got some really cool holes with some great little green complexes. And, you know, I think if that place ever got any money put into it, I think it would be the best nine-hole course in the world, probably.
I got to get out to Hawaii. In my book, it would be Dunes Club number one by a pretty wide margin. Mike Kaiser's Playground in southwestern Michigan is just a terrific place. Again, it's got the architecture, it's got the vibe, it's got so many holes that can be played by from different angles, from different tees, that really changes the composition of the golf course, which I think is terrific. A close second would be Whitensville, south of Boston, which is an old Donald Ross nine-hole course that is both beautiful and just terrific to play. Absolute blast. Anybody who lives in the Northeast needs to see that place. And then beyond that, it gets a little bit tough. There are a couple that I know I will love that I need to see, like Culver and Sweden's Cove. But I think Dunes Club in Whitensville would be the clear top of the list for me for nine-hole courses.
Yeah,
another cool little nine-hole course in St. George, Utah is the Sand Hollow Lynx Nine at at Sand Hollow. I think that's probably the best course in Utah. So that's another cool one to check out if you're ever in the area.
That place looks
like that's a great one.
About as visually stunning as any course I've ever seen. That Sand Hollow.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable.
I played a cool little nine hole down in Orlando, Winter Park. It's like it was 2,400 yards, and then they brought in Keith Reb and Riley Johns, and then also Blake Conant, the two of the guys, you know, that have done a ton of work for Coren Crenshaw, and they turned this little place, like, it's, you know, nine holes, 2,400 yards, and it's like really, it's kind of like strategic, tough. The greens are amazing, the complexes, the bunkering is phenomenal. Like, if you short side yourself out there, you are just toast. I think I made four birdies and four bogeys and nine. I think nine-hole golf is has got to get more popular. I think it's awesome. You know, it's you know, 18 is a long time suck for, you know, some people. I think these 9-hole courses, I think, are so cool. So, speaking
yeah,
of...
I completely agree.
Speaking of...
I love non-traditional courses.
Yeah. That plays right into the next question I had. What kind of unique golf designs would you like to see more of in the future, whether it's like that Sheep Ranch model where it's tee the ball anywhere, play to any hole, more so like, you know, they have like 9 greens and you can play it any way you want, like 5-hole courses or short courses, putting courses. What do you guys kind of would you like to see more of in the future?
I think like 9-hole courses and par 3, like little 9-hole par 3 courses. The other ones are really cool concepts, I think, to me. You know, like the 5-hole courses or the, you know, the Sheep Ranch type deal where you can play to any green you want. They're really cool on paper, but if you ever get any demand and people actually want to go play that type of place, it gets really hard, you know, when there's multiple groups out there and they're like, you know, a couple people are trying to go to the same green and people are hitting over people's heads. Like, they sound really cool, but I just don't think they work. So, I mean, what we were just saying, I think 9-hole courses are very undervalued and very, you know, no one seems to want to build them for whatever reason, but, you know, I think they're really fun. Like, that Kahuku course is as cool as it gets, and, you know, it takes, you know, an hour and a half or 2 hours, and you're out of there, max.
Yeah, I mean, Zach is right about the Sheep Ranch course, and we talked about this recently, but there's another model where that we were speaking about where you could play as a 9-hole par 3 course, a 3-hole full-length course, and what have you, but it's just not workable if there's more than a group or two out there, because otherwise it's just a crossfire. So I do agree, though. For me, Friar's Head does this perfectly if you're talking about little extras for the members that make the course a really fun place or the club a really fun place to be. Friar's Head has its big 18-hole Coeur Crenshaw course, which is fantastic. But beyond that, they also have a 9-hole par 3 course that you can go play around on if you just want to get a quick loop in. They have an incredible practice facility with 2 short game greens and a full driving range. And then they have a Himalaya-style full putting course that you can play on for as long as you want to. And I just think that those are incredible amenities for either a membership or for a resort to have as an alternative to going out on the big course and maybe losing 4 hours that you might not otherwise have. If it were up to me, every club that could afford one would have a putting course. I just think they're incredibly fun. I think it's a relatively inexpensive way to add a very desirable feature, an alternative feature to a course, and I think you'll see a lot of that in the near future at high-end clubs that have the room to put one down.
Yeah, I think it's I heard Ballyneal in Colorado is putting in like a Himalaya-style course. They've got a lot of stuff. That's a cool place I want to check out this year. So since we've got, you know, 3 of the biggest McDonald and Rainer fans on the planet on this podcast, I think we have to talk a little bit about, you know, template golf, and curious what you got, your guys' favorite template holes are, and, you know, why they're your favorite.
I really like the Punch Bowl Alps combo, like at Fisher's Island. I think it's really cool just kind of hitting to that flagpole and then kind of getting up to the top of the hill and seeing where your ball ended up. I think it's, you know, a hole that they don't build as much as I think they should anymore. It's just a fun way to spice things up. But I would say that or a Biarritz green probably.
Yeah, I mean, the 3rd at National and the 4th at Fisher's Island are probably 2 of my 10 favorite holes that I've ever played. So I certainly agree. I don't know why you don't see as many of them as you used to, but it's certainly one that I love. I also love the Levin template that you don't see too often, but whenever I play a Rainer course that still has its leaving hole intact,
it always ends up being one of my favorites on the golf course. And of course, the Redan is always a wonderful hole to play.
Yeah, it's interesting. I met a member of a club. I'll keep it nameless. You know, I don't want to bother anybody, but they brought in a architect who looked at their Alps Punch Bowl template, and they, you know, they were having drainage problems, which is one of the reasons that modern architecture went away from the Punch Bowl, even though they had technology that could help those drainage problems. And you know, this unnamed architect who has a track record for, you know, dismantling Rainer courses, he said, you know, you need to just raise this punch bowl green up, and he turned the green into a plateau green. I mean, that's just what happened in the, you know, 70s, 80s, and 90s, I think. And hopefully, it seems like we're getting back to punch bowls. I know Gil Hans has a new one at Stream Song Black that I saw that looks pretty cool. I'd say in terms of my favorite template hole, I'm a sucker for the short. I think that I've made so many bogeys on short holes because, like, the green is just so tough. If you don't hit it in the exact right spot, you know, you're going to walk away with a bogey.
I mean, I think, the way we talk about these holes, it's pretty unbelievable to hear that, you know, how much we love the punch bowl and how much we love the Redan and how much we love the short and the Levin and the road hole and stuff like that. And to see it not built more, it's just, it like mind-boggling every day when I think about it. I'm just like, where did people fall off the wagon and think that it was, you know, okay to stop building these courses? I mean, they were used at every one of, you know, Rainer and McDonald courses, and people loved all their courses. All their courses are so unbelievably fun to play that it was like they understood if it wasn't broke, why try and fix it? And they kept using it and kept working. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then someone came along and was like, you know, we shouldn't do those anymore. We should build, you know, a course that is so hard and people, you know, are going to lose all these golf balls and they can't remember any of the holes. Like, I mean, we remember all these template holes so well because they're so enjoyable and fun. It's just like all of them are so good at the end of the day. They're all awesome.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. These are holes with a defined and demonstrated and very long track record of success. And like you said, people adore these holes. It makes no sense to me. And when you see some of these Rainer courses up and around New York and some of the courses that Charlie Banks built using these templates, a lot of these courses are on really dull pieces of land. But the fact that they put these templates in and adapted them to that land, they were able to turn an otherwise very mediocre piece of ground into a course, like Zach said, that you remember every hole on the golf course. If it was just a normal, typical, modern-day design, you'd walk off the course and you wouldn't be able to remember a thing. It's mind-boggling is the perfect phrase for it.
Yeah.
Like, when I go to a course built by, I mean, it's really sad to say, and I harp on it every time I get on a podcast or talk about it, but any course that's been built in the last, like, 40 years, I could, you know, I remember holes really good, but, I mean, I can't differentiate half the par threes that any of these architects build because they want to build every par three at 205 to 225 and have a small green that's hard to hit and you got to carry a bunker and so you can't even get a shot close to a front pin, especially if it's downwind, and then half the time they're downhill, and it's just like I can't even remember any of the par threes. And then you go to a McDonald or a Rainer course and you got these template holes and you literally remember them to a T, exactly the way they played, exactly how the green was, and you know why you like it so much was so defined because they kept doing the same stuff over and over. So it's so weird to me.
Yeah, I think everybody got in their own way, you know, and wanted to create their own genius when really the greatest architects just took the principles from, you know, the British Isles and what old Tom Morris was doing and James Braid, and, you know, really just, you know, kind of learned from them, as opposed to, you know, I think in the 50s, 60s, they got their technology, all of a sudden they could use CAD and create, you know, I always laugh when I look at bunkers, it's like, you can tell when they had the computer software, because all of a sudden these bunkers are perfect little circles and they look completely awful. I think John touched on Levin being an underappreciated template hole. Zach, do you have a underappreciated template hole?
Man, I really like kind of the, you know, you've talked about it a lot, the kind of like the volcano type green that kind of falls off on all the sides. I don't think that's used as much as it should be on some of those shorter kind of risk reward drivable type par fours. I think that's something that is missing out on a lot of places, I think.
Yeah, volcano greens are really cool. I know, like, have you played out of Bedford Springs, John?
Yes.
They've got a good one, right?
They do. They do. Bedford Springs is a really underrated Ross course. A lot of fun to play. Neat elevation change. The course kind of sits in a valley between two mountains, so the holes play up the sides, which is how you end up with a volcano hole that fits the surroundings very well. But it's a neat place. And yes, that is a really nice example of the volcano template.
Yeah, another great one is a short little par four. Holston Hills has a great one. Lulu Country Club has a great one. I got to do a post on volcano holes. It'll be one of these in the future. So outside, you know, I think we've talked enough. We'll still talk probably more Rainer, McDonald, Banks. So if you were going to go play a golf course in a city and somebody had to say, you know, we've got every architect that's designed a course here, and you can't choose McDonald, Rainer, or Banks, who are you going with and why?
I'd go with McKenzie.
Yeah, I probably would too. You know, I don't know if I've ever played a McKenzie course that I don't really, really like. So I would probably say him, or I've played a lot of Tillinghast courses that I really have enjoyed. You know, Somerset Hills is one of my favorite courses in the world, and that's kind of one of the places that I've said that if I could choose one course to play for the rest of my life, that might be the one. So, you know, I think I might have to throw his name in the mix too.
Yeah, I think
Tillinghast is one of my all-time favorites as well. And Somerset Hills, first course I ever did a photo tour of. It is an amazing place. It's my favorite Tillinghast course by a pretty good margin, and certainly one of my favorite courses in the area. So I can certainly respect that pick.
Yeah, that's Tilly. I think William Flynn's really criminally underrated. I haven't played a bad Flynn course. I'd probably go with McKenzie or Tilly too. So if you guys could restore or renovate one golf course in America, what would it be and why?
I think I would do Augusta and take it back to kind of how it was originally. I see some pictures of some of those green complexes back in the day, the really wild looking ones that are, and some of those the bunkers, how they were, like a little more cypress pointy with the kind of jagged lines, and they weren't all so perfect. I think that would be a really cool place. Not that Augusta isn't amazing, but I think that would kind of be a cool little thing to get it back to the way it was when they first built that place.
Oh, man, that's amazing. It's, I think, yeah, you look at it now, and obviously, it's gets a lot of coverage and there's all sorts of synonymous love for it, but what it was originally to what it is now is it's a shell of itself, and you know, a certain family got their hands on it for a while, which we'll keep nameless. What about you, John?
So I would love to do a very faithful and caring restoration at Yale. It's one of my favorite courses as it is. It's an iconic McDonald Rainer course. But I would love to put the third green back where it's supposed to be. And I would love to just touch up the course, widen the greens out to their original sizes, sharpen up the edges again, get the conditioning under control so that the course played firmer and faster and bouncier and the ball started moving on the ground like it's supposed to there. And I think if you got the right person to do that and spent a little bit of money to get it where it could be, it would be one of the 10 or 20 best courses in the world.
Yeah, I remember playing Yale. I went up there last year after the PGA, right before the Hartford event. And, you know, obviously I'm a big CB McDonald, Seth Rainer fan, so I really enjoyed it. But I thought, I mean, I thought the same thing. I just couldn't believe the, you know, the condition the place was in. You know, especially with, I mean, that place has got to just be, they've got to have some deep pockets around that area, obviously, that I think they could do so much with that place. And, I mean, it's a shame that it's not in, like, mint condition, to be honest.
Yeah, and look, I'm not a conditioning freak. You know, I don't mind playing courses that are a little scruffy. I don't, you know, I'm not one of these guys that needs wall-to-wall green everywhere. And I know you're not either, Zach. The problem I have with it is, the conditions at Yale impact the way the golf course plays, and it keeps the course from playing like McDonald and Rainer wanted and expected it to play. It's so soft, the ball doesn't move on the ground like it has to take advantage of those wonderful architectural features that they have there. It's just, it's really, in my view, a tragedy, just knowing what it could be if, and I don't even think it would take that much work. I don't know why. I mean, granted, it's a very difficult piece of property, and I'm sure that there are drainage issues that I haven't even thought of. I mean, I'm not an architect. But it's just, given what they have there and the amazing architectural bones of that place, it's something that I would desperately like to see at some point.
Not to mention the alumni base, you know? It's like, I imagine...
That's what I'm saying.
You could get a fundraiser together and a couple million bucks pretty easily, and you could... Yeah. You know, get a guy like Silva who's done, you know, great jobs with Rainer restorations and get him out there, and it would be, you know, I'd imagine that the course, given what I've seen from photos and, you know, how bold the design is, I mean, it would be a top 50 golf course in the country, no problem.
Easily. Yeah, I mean, I'm dead serious when I tell you that if you gave Silva a couple million bucks and a year to do his work, you're ending up with a top 20 golf course. And as far as the money goes, look, I mean, I don't throw a couple million dollars around easily, but I will tell you this, the you know, you're talking about a fundraiser. Yale has an endowment of $25 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars. You'd think that just for the good of the game, they could carve off a little slice of that and throw it at the golf course, if you know what I mean.
I don't even think that's a slice when you're talking billions. That's like a little crumb. That's a little crumb.
Right.
Yeah. It would be good for the students, you know? Be good for their well-being.
Yeah, I'm playing with a Yale alum this week at the Pebble Beach. Maybe I'll have a little talk with her about it, see if she can get things working over there.
Yeah, get on there.
Which player is, you know?
Get on there as a consultant.
No, we'll do it. The three of us will do it for half fee.
I like that. That'll be my first big gig.
Yeah.
All
right. So, what's one architect that you haven't seen a lot of, that you're looking forward to seeing more of? Like, you know, I always think that when you see a handful of golf courses by an architect, every time you play a new one, you get a greater appreciation for them. So I'm curious who you guys want to see more of.
I'd probably say, you know, you mentioned it earlier, but, you know, William Flynn, you know, you hear of some of the courses that he's done that are so amazing. And I have a couple friends that are huge fans of his, and they, you know, tell me that he's their favorite. And I've only seen a couple, and they've both been really, really good. So probably him.
Well, Zach, come on out here, because we are spoiled with William Flynn courses in the Philadelphia area. We have great ones everywhere out this way. For me, it would either be McKenzie. I'm kind of on a little bit of a McKenzie hunt lately, given that I just played my first couple of them over the last 18 months or so, and obviously love his work so far. I think I've played 6 of his courses in total, and I'd like to get that number up. Like Zach said earlier, I've yet to see one of his courses that I didn't really like. But beyond that, I'd love to see some more Langford courses.
Yeah, that's you got to come to the Midwest, John. We can do. I've been talking to this to Blake Conant, who's a construction guy for, you know, golf courses, and he wants to do a Langford Moreau tour where we play like 5 courses in 3 days.
You guys are pretty lucky, you know. You're sitting here saying, "I want to, you know, I want to see more of this," and you say, "Come here," and you say, "I want to see more of this," and you say, "Well, you come to Philly," and I'm stuck out there in Utah where there's absolutely no good ones. So,
you know, Zach, I think you got the world's smallest violin, given your occupation.
Yeah, good point. Good point.
You know, another.
I will agree with you there. Nobody has paid me to play golf yet. So.
It's,
you guys are right. That was bad timing.
Yeah, and
well, anyway, you're fixing the Utah problem anyway, right, Zach? So, you know, pretty soon that won't be a problem.
Yeah, that's the plan.
There's another guy I've been wanting to see is A.B. McCann, who designed a ton of courses up in the Northwest, and, you know, these guys that follow Fried Egg have been telling me all about them. But, you know, one of the places he originally laid out was Cal Club, and then he's just got, you know, a flood of designs up in Oregon and Washington. Lots of great country clubs. You know, obviously one of the big problems up there is that they are very, very overgrown, so probably all need big tree removal projects done.
A.B. McCann, just point out, lawyer by day.
See, that's why you need to get
hired
for the CL.
Is there any golf course architects, like, around, you know, that are building courses right now that you guys would want to go see more of their stuff?
Good question. I mean, I'll play any Core Crenshaw course based on name alone. I think their work is sort of the best of the modern architects, along with Tom Doak. I mean, anywhere I go, if there's a course by one of those guys, I will check it out, just assuming that it's going to be very good, given what I've seen of their work already. Gil Hance is another guy I really like. I was talking to Andy about this the other day. David Eschler is a guy who's moving up on that list for me, given the little that I've seen of his work and what I'm hearing about his the work that he's currently doing. But those are really my guys. I mean, there's not many modern architects whose name alone will draw me to the course beyond the ones I just gave you.
You know, I'm really excited to. I want to go up to the Pacific Northwest. There's this guy, Dan Hixon, who I met at the PGA show. He's been working for 9 years on this reversible course. Obviously, Doak's opened last year, but this guy's been working on this reversible course for almost a decade. And he's got just like the most incredible story. So he has no social media handles. He has no website. You know, and I'm like, how do people get a hold of you? He goes, I figure they'll, you know, find a way to get a hold of me if they really want to. And it turned, you know, he played professionally. He's, you know, his father was a golf pro in the area, and he was a head pro. And then one day he just decided he wanted to be a golf course architect, quit his job, and didn't go work for anybody, worked for himself, started doing like tees and bunker, like singular tees and bunkers for courses around the Pacific Northwest. And now I think this will be his third solo design, but, you know, kind of a crazy story. I'm actually writing about it now. So that guy I really want to see. And then Dave Essler, he's got this project called Pacific Gales, which is on the Oregon coast. And from what I've heard, it might be a better piece of property than any of the Bandon courses, which is crazy.
That Dan Hickson guy does a lot of good stuff up there too. A lot of people, you know, always are in my ear about that guy, you know, trying to get him to help out and stuff like that. So I think there's a lot of good guys, you know, a lot of people that do it now, I think, are pretty good. I think my biggest knock on anybody who builds golf courses right now, every single one of them makes the greens way too challenging and way too crazy. I just think you see so many of those old golf courses that are so fun and enjoyable. The greens are so tame. And, you know, there's a handful of greens on a lot of those old courses that are wild, you know, but they're at appropriate places, whether it's, you know, a par five or a short par four, or, you know, occasionally on a little par three. But, you know, for the most part, the greens on those really good golf courses from the golden age, they're so fun to putt. You know, they're not crazy and not too wild, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I'm now getting to be playing a good amount of Doak courses, and that's just like my common complaint with them. I thought Streamsong Blue, he did the best job I've seen, where, like, he, you know, it's like, you know, like, you want to challenge a great player with these greens, but, you know, you got to give somebody a place to land the ball. Like, I hate when you hit a shot 10 feet from the flag and it spins down to like 80 feet away, or, you know, if you land it 1 yard further, it would kick off the back of the green. Like, that to me is not, you know, that's not challenging. That's just kind of stupid, you know? And I think, I would agree with you in certain extent with, you know, I think a lot of new architects do a great job with it, though. I think Bill Coore and Crenshaw do an awesome job rewarding really good golf shots, while, you know, like, if you hit an average one, you don't have a good look. I think, like, making it relatively flat around the pin is so, you know, people try and, it's like anything, they try and reinvent the wheel, but, like, you know, if I hit it to 8 feet on a 440-yard par four, I should be given a pretty good look at birdie.
Yeah, yep, I agree.
And not only that, but you'll also end up with ancillary benefits like better pace of play. You give the golfer the feeling like he can make some putts as opposed to just trying to lag everything through the crazy humps and swales. And you don't have as many three putts, which, you know, nobody likes the three putt. So you end up with a happier golfer at the end of the round too. I mean, that's what you said it. You look at these old classic courses, what do you see? You see huge greens that aren't necessarily flat and boring, but that have spots where you can make putts. And, you know, that's certainly my preference. You talk about the Alps Punch Bowl green. Just think about that green at Fisher's Island. It's this gigantic green that has a dividing hump running through the middle of it. But if you're on the correct side of the green, you're going to have a really nice look at a birdie, whether it's from 5 feet or 20 feet, because the greens, other than that one feature, are relatively tame. To me, that's all you really need. You know, you don't need 50 different swales and mounds and bumps and bounces in every single green on the course. There's a place for it, I think. Monterey Peninsula Dunes Club is a great example of it. The fifth green there, it's this drivable par four, and the green is just insane. If you made 18 of those, you'd have a problem. But in isolation, in moderation, that kind of extreme green, I think, does have a place. It's just when they go over the top with it and you end up with stressful putting situations time and time again, like Andy said, no matter how good your approach shots are, I just don't find that to be a whole lot of fun.
Yeah, my biggest thing that I hate is when I get onto a green, you know, of one of those newer courses, and I've, you know, hit a couple of decent shots, I guess, and maybe I haven't played that course enough to know where all the right places to miss are, and I'm stuck all of a sudden with a putt where I literally have no chance to get this ball close. You know, the best you're going to do is 12 feet. If you hit like the miracle best putt of your life, you're going to have like a 12 footer. And I don't see that all that often on some of those older courses. You know, I don't think you're in spots where you can't get it close as much on those older courses as you are on the newer courses that are, you know, being built today.
Hey, did you watch the end of that golf last week, the playoff?
I didn't.
Which one are you talking about, Andy?
The Waste Management.
The one
with Simpson?
Yes, I did. I saw the playoff.
Where he ended up, so on 17, Zach, he ended up with that back pin. He ended up,
couldn't get
on the back right corner. Nobody said anything. I almost said something, but I was like, that's kind of a stupid pin, you know?
I didn't hear them say something during the telecast.
That's an interesting hole. I don't know where he was, but you can. On that hole, like if you're on the green, if you're on the back right of that green and the pin's all the way in that back little finger, you can like boomerang it around. There is a way, but if you don't hit it really good, you know, you could like hit it in the bunker or in the water. So, I mean, that's a really interesting hole. But again, that's one of those areas where it is on like a 320-yard drivable hole. You know, that makes you think, do I want to hit a driver up there? And if I don't hit it good, I'm totally botched over on the right where I don't have any sort of angle. Like, that's why Hideki was hitting his 3-wood on that hole to the front of the green, because even if he blocked it, he knew that he would have a shot.
Yeah.
So that's one that I don't mind as much, you know, because it makes you think off the tee. You know, if Webb was going to hit one out there to the right with a driver or whatever he hit, and got it too far up, then he was really kind of jimmied there and wouldn't have a good angle. So that's kind of like more of a strategic thing there, because that green's not too out of control by any means. It's just if you miss that shot in the wrong spot, like with a drive going for the green, you can be in a really, really bad spot. Weisskopf is actually, so he redid that course, you know. I don't know if he built that course and redid it, but they redid that a couple of years ago. And he redid the North course at Torrey Pines. And I thought he did a really good job. I've actually really enjoyed both of those redos. I thought he did a really good job with them.
You know, he did TPC Deer Run too.
That's another course that I think is really, really fun. They got a little drivable hole there, too, that I think it's like the 15th hole or something like that, or 14. And it's kind of the same thing. They can get a back pin there that if you do decide to go for it with a driver and you hit it right of the green, you can literally have no angle. And you can be in a really bad spot where you just have to like chip it out and take like a 20 footer. But again, that's on a rare circumstance where it is a drivable hole. And that's the same thing with 17. It's kind of like that at TPC Sawgrass. I mean, TPC, that one last week, TPC Phoenix, Scottsdale, whatever.
I like Deer Run. I think it's pretty solid little track. It's cool. There's a couple of little quirks and goofy things about it, but I feel like, you know,
that's where me and you met.
Yeah, yeah. That was first interview. I've probably played tournament golf out there like 15, 20 times. It's a cool little course. Great value too. I think you can play two rounds out there with the replay rate for like $130 peak season, which, you know,
the last 2 years it has poured. I haven't got to play that place firm and fast like you see it, you know. I mean, dang, when Stricker and Zach Johnson were winning out there like 8 out of 9 years, that place was so firm. It had like the longest drives on tour. You know, people were hitting it like 370 and like 360 on some of those holes. It was just rolling forever. And I was just like keeping my fingers crossed that this year that I can actually get a drive over 300 yards maybe once.
What's it like playing with like a guy like Gary Woodland? Where like I mean, like what are you thinking about when you're out there and he's hitting it like wedge and you're hitting, you know, a mid iron in?
I think the craziest example maybe ever was I played with Bubba at the Players one year last year in a practice round, and I remember getting up on. What hole is it? It's like maybe hole six, and it's a short hole, but I liked to hit driver up there because if I hit a good drive, I got a wedge. And, you know, some of the guys were maybe laying back with irons or whatever, and I thought it was a good hole for me to, you know, if I hit it good, it was kind of an advantage for me to get it up there. And so I was hitting driver one day in this practice round, and I just, like, smoked a couple of them. And Bubba's like, hand me the two iron. And he was hitting this, like, 30-yard, like, low fade, like, getting a foot off the ground. You know, this thing is, like, going 20 yards past my driver. And I got out there and was like, are you kidding me? I was like, this guy's hitting iron past my driver. I was like, this is the most crazy thing ever. And, I mean, I see it all the time. Guys just bombing it way past me. But, you know, I figure if I can make some putts and hit some good long irons, it kind of makes up for it.
Yeah, lots of ways to skin a cat, you know?
Yeah, the 300-yard drive helps skin it faster, though, so.
I would think so.
Is Bubba, do you think he's the most, like, who's, like, the guy that you are most in kind of awe of, like, the way they play? Is he the number one guy that's, like, just kind of, like, from a, just watching play, like, kind of shocking?
Yeah, I think he plays, you know, he just plays solely off feel, you know. He hits all these wild shots and can do so much with the golf ball. It's pretty amazing to see. He hits it so far and he can hit it so high, and it's just pretty wild. It's pretty cool to see.
All right, so let's get back on subject here with golf courses. John and Zach, would love to hear both of you, you know, some trips you got lined up that you're excited about for the summer.
Yeah, sure. I'm going back to Northern California at the end of April. I'm awfully excited to get back out there, see what we can find to play in that area. I'm sure there's a few courses left. I'm finally going to hit Ohio for a long overdue golf trip. We talked a little about this last time, Andy, but there are just so many courses out there that I'm dying to see. So that'll be a good one. And then I have my wife's big trip to Idaho this summer for her big race that I'm going to tag along for and play the Coeur d'Alene courses, play Rock Creek Cattle Company, which I really am looking forward to seeing. Maybe go up into Canada and play Banff, and then maybe do a little bit of a western trip from there to play Gaza Ranch and Gamble Sands in Washington. So that's one I'm really looking forward to this summer.
Well, I'm excited. Next week, I'm hopefully going to go play the Valley Club, which is Mackenzie Gym down on the way to Los Angeles, and then I usually try and get over to LACC during the week sometime. So those are anticipated. I love LA. I've played there a bunch, but it's always one that I like to go back to. And then I'm gonna go play the Everglades Club during the week of the Honda. So I'm excited to go play that little Seth Rayner track. I've heard it's a cool little quirky little place. So I'm excited to see that. But some of the ones, you know, I've had a couple people help out and try and get me out at Yeaman's Hall, which I've wanted to see for a while. And then, you know, I always talk about Essex and Myopia Hunt. So those are kind of the ones that I really want to see, I guess. And then, I haven't played, obviously, enough golf in San Francisco. So, you know, Cal Club and SF Club or two that I really want to go check out.
Awesome.
Have you played Valley Club yet, Zach?
No, I haven't. now every year after, you know, I always drive the whole West Coast. So we drive from Pebble down to L.A., and I mean, we drive right past it, and I'm always like, next year we'll play, and then the next year passes, and I'm like, we'll go next year. But never have.
It's so good. You're going to love it.
Yeah.
It's
I've seen a lot of pictures of that place.
It's just beautiful. You'll love it.
So where do you guys stand LACC versus RIV?
I'm a huge LA fan, so I mean, it's not even an argument for me, but that's just how I feel, I guess.
I think Riviera is a terrific golf course that I would happily play any time that I'm in LA. I think it's rightfully considered one of the top 100 or even top 50 golf courses in the United States. I think it's easily worthy of that designation. But to me, LACC is in another universe. LACC is one of the 10 best courses that I've ever played. I think it is phenomenal in every respect. I am desperate to get back out there and see the newly renovated South Course, but the North Course at LACC is top 10 in the country for me, as far as I'm concerned. I just think it's amazing.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. I mean, RIV is awesome. It's really, really good. But like John said, LA is just, it's in a different league, I think. And I actually got to go out and check out the renovated South Course when they were building it last year with Jeff Shackelford. And he took me around the place and showed me all the plans and stuff like that. And we went kind of hole by hole. And that place is going to be really, really cool. I think that will be, you know, on that list of best 36-hole clubs, because I think it'll be such a perfect secondary course. It's a shorter track, and it's going to be really fun and a lot of, you know, different looks. So I'm really excited to check that out.
That's awesome. So let's get to some Twitter questions here before I let you guys go. So Chester wants to know, what's the best golf course under 6,800 yards from the tips?
Easy, Cypress Point.
Yeah, Cypress is. I don't know how long Fisher's Island is, but Fisher's has got to be Fisher's has got to be in that argument as well.
Short Acres.
Yeah, Fisher's really good, and there's no way Fisher's is over 6,800 yards.
Yeah, Shore Acres is under 6,800. That's another great course. Lots of great golf courses under 6,800 yards. I think out in Philly.
To be honest with you, I bet you most of the McRaynor courses that we know and love are under 6,800 yards. I mean, I bet you that 80% of them are under 6,800. And by the way, as I'm looking at my little iPad right now, Somerset Hills, which we all love, is 6,756 from the tips. So that should be on that list as well.
Yep, for sure.
I think yardage is so overrated when it comes to difficulty. And I think we're seeing it more and more. Like, to a certain extent, like, it's all based off of conditioning. If it's firm and fast, and you probably can attest to this more, Zach, but that's the ultimate defense, I imagine, for a golf course. When it's soft, these guys will tear it up, you know, and you'll tear it up regardless.
Yeah, like a perfect example of that is like the Utah Championship. You know, they had it at Thanksgiving Point, which is like this really long golf course, like around 8,000 yards. But it was so firm, and it's in the summer. And I kept trying to tell the guys like that set up the tournament and that run the thing, that I said, listen, guys, it doesn't matter how firm this place is. I mean, how long this place is. If it's this firm, guys are going to be hitting it 400 yards in Utah. You know, the ball's rolling forever. So yardage, I think, honestly, you can kind of throw it out the window because, like you said, if you get it on a firm day, you can get the ball rolling so far that, you know, yardages don't really mean all that much. And then the second point you said, if it gets soft, it doesn't matter how long the golf course is. guys are going to play good when you can aim at the stick and hit it on a number, and it's going to stop on that number. These guys out here are so good that it doesn't matter. You could have 600-yard par fours, and guys are going to make pars because they can hit their third shot to 10 feet and make the putt. So it yardage, I don't think, really matters at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting you say that, Zach, because from my perspective as somebody who is not nearly the caliber of golfer that the two of you are, when it's firm and fast, it actually allows me, no matter how long the course has been playing, and I'm not a long hitter by any means, it sort of neutralizes that advantage that raw length gives and allows me to play with guys who hit it much, much further than I do, because it brings all the other elements of my game into play, and I can get some back with, you know, creativity and good play around the greens or making putts. Whereas if it's just a long, stretched out, soft course, I'm at a natural disadvantage if I'm just hitting hybrids into every green where my opponent's hitting 7-irons or 8-irons or wedges. And, you know, the softer the course, the easier it's going to be to dial in those yardages, like you were saying. So I just, for a player of my caliber, or lack of caliber, I guess, it's always nice when that distance issue is sort of negated by a really well-conditioned, firm and fast course.
Yeah, firm and fast is the way to go.
Yeah. And by the way, on our list of under 6,800-yard courses, two that I feel compelled to mention, Eastward Ho on the Cape up in Massachusetts, which is one of my all-time favorites, maxes out at something like 6,300 yards, and it is as good a course as you'll ever want to play. So that's a great one. And then Crystal Downs is another one that I was thinking of that I think is about 6,500 yards from the back, which is easily one of the best courses in the country. It's amazing when you look at it how many of these truly classic courses are under 6,800 yards that I think are, you know, universally loved and appreciated by all caliber of players. So it really does say something, I think, about distance and how its impact is so overrated by so many people.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you get some of those courses that are short like that, but they got cross bunkers and they got hazards in the right places that force you to make decisions, like, do I take this hazard on with a driver or a three wood and bring, you know, big numbers into play, or do I just lay back and have a mid iron in? Which, you know, that does the whole thing of negating what a total yardage of a golf course is. Because if you're going to lay back with a 3-iron or a hybrid off the tee and take a 6-iron in, that's making those 385 to 440-yard holes into long par fours. You know what I mean? Because if you're hitting mid-iron in, it doesn't matter what you hit off the tee. You're still hitting a mid-iron in into the green. So I think that's where those guys were so good back then at, you know, strategically placing the hazards in the right spot that made you think. Because now, you know, a lot of the times you just see a couple hazards on, you know, you see a bunker on the left and a bunker on the right, and you can hit it as far as you want, dead straight, yep, and that shortened the golf hole, you know. And the guys, you know, the driver is one of the easiest clubs in the bag to hit now because of how forgiving it is and, you know, how good the balls are and everything like that. Guys can hit it long and straight. You know, they get, you know, when you throw something in the middle of the fairway or something that you kind of have to think about, that's when golf gets a little harder and gets a little, you know, tougher to think about shots.
Yeah.
Great point.
I agree. I had Michael Clayton on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, he was spectacular. And, he, you know, he's got this old school golf, you know, kind of vibe to him. And the thing he thought that was just so criminal about the professional game is that, you know, he thinks everybody should have to carry a 2-iron. Whether they use it or not, they should have to know how to hit a 2-iron, because what technology's done has decreased the skill out of the game.
I was talking to Jeff Ogilvy the other day, and, you know, he was talking to my crowd a little bit. They were talking about tennis and how in some of the Grand Slams and, you know, the big tennis tournaments, they actually dial back the golf, you know, the tennis ball, and make the courts a little softer and stuff like that. And he said they do basically the same thing in the professional game in golf. You know, the courts, they're so wet. wet most of the time, and they don't like to see the ball running and rolling and bouncing and, you know, getting those big hops on the greens. They like to see, you know, it spin back, and they like to see it be able to, you know, stop it next to the hole. That they've kind of, you know, made the PGA Tour golf and, you know, golf in general kind of like slow court tennis, to where it kind of affects the game and doesn't make it as fun or as skillful. You know, you just kind of hit it at a target and it stops next to the hole, and that's all you have to do. You know, sometimes when you go over to Scotland and stuff like that, and you play the ground game, and you have to really know how, you know, how a ball is going to react and how far you want this thing to run out. You got to use different contours and different slopes. That's when golf is really fun and more challenging, I think, than just having to hit it 140 yards and it's going to stop at 140 if you hit it that distance. So I think I agree with him. You know, I think skill's been taken a little bit out of the game. Not to say that the people out here aren't extremely talented and extremely good, but it's just a different game, you know. You just kind of hit it as far straight as you can and then hit it straight at the flag, you know, 90% of the time.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and just to give you the other perspective again, like Zach said, you know, when you're talking about a higher handicapper like I am, I mean, certainly I can't master my yardages like you or Zach can. But so the more the golf course rewards that style of golf, the bigger the differential gets between, you know, me playing to a six and the guy playing to a three, and me and you two and guys at your level, where you can't really play a functional match on that kind of a course when the skill level diverges to a certain point. But the more you bring in that ground game, the more you bring in the ability to be creative and be strategic and do things that aren't necessarily entirely physical, the more fun the game becomes, in my view. Again, and that's just the perspective of a mediocre hack, but that's how I feel.
You know, John, you've put me in Zach's skill level way too much tonight for me not to say. Like, it's
hey,
not
man,
even,
from my perspective, looking up at you guys, you I mean, either one of you is going to kick my ass the exact same way. So you are the same skill level. Somebody like me.
There's a whole another level that he's on that is so much different than what I'm on. So let's
you know,
let's
where
just put
this
that
all
up.
Remind you know where all this kind of takes me back to like. A perfect place for us to go play would be National. You know, we could all go out there and figure out a nice game to play, and we're all going to go out and make a couple of birdies. You know, some of them might be made in different ways. You know, maybe I drive number two, but, you know, then we get to a short par three where, you know, you don't have to hit it 220 yards on a rope. You know, you just got to be creative and get it in the right spot and kind of funnel a shot in certain places like that. That's why National and some of the Seth Rainer, C.B. McDonald courses are so good, in my opinion, because you can take a guy that's a 7 handicap, and you can take a guy that's a scratch player, and you can take a professional golfer, and you could all go out there and have fun and enjoy it, to where you could go out to a, you know, a championship track, you know, a place like Baltusrol, and I'm probably going to be the only one making a lot of birdies out there if I play good. You know, it's just a hard golf course. Somebody that's a 6 handicap that doesn't hit it 300 yards is going to have a really hard time out there.
I can verify that firsthand. Baldessarre crushed me. And a player like you, Zach, would beat me by 50 at Baldessarre, and I would have a miserable time. And we couldn't have any kind of functional match. And to me, that's a tragedy, especially given the match play roots of the game. But you're right. At a place like National, even carrying my 6 and even hitting the ball much shorter than you guys do, I can get around National, and I can score at National because I can use the parts of my game that are strong to get the ball in the hole. At a place like Baldessarre, if I can't hit it as far as I need to, I have no option. It's either make the carry or don't. It's either hit the fairway or don't. It's either hit the green or don't. And if any of those don'ts happen, I'm making bogey or worse. Where at National, I don't need to hit it 250 yards to make a par. You know, I don't need to hit every green in regulation and two putt just to get around the course. I can do other things that don't require physical skills that I don't have. And to me, that is really what makes those courses a treasure to all kinds of players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah, I agree. That's the best.
I play with a guy who plays on the web tour, and we've got a foursome that we play a couple times in the summer, and it's, you know, three really good mid-am players and him, and we played Olympia Fields North, so U.S. Open course, and he shot 68, and then we had like 75, 77, 82. You know, and it's like a perfect example. Then we go out to Sand Valley, and it's super playable, you know, where there's all kinds of options in play. He ended up beating us, but it was a lot closer than the drubbing he gave us at Olympia Fields North.
Yeah, I mean, went in when I wanted, when my first, you know, inklings and ideas of the Buck Club came around, I wanted to build like a championship style track that was like meant for a scratch golfer, and you know, it was really hard and it was gonna beat you up and you had to play really good. And then my kind of whole world flipped around when I saw some places like National, and I saw, you know, some of these unbelievable, just classic little gems that are quirky and fun and sporty, and you know, they're not long yardages. It's just so much more fun to play a golf course that anybody in your foursome can play, no matter if they're like, you know, a long handicap or a scratch player. It's just more fun for everybody when you build a course like that, that everyone can get it around and make birdies and have fun.
Right. Right.
All right.
Right. To me, that's the biggest difference, Zach. It tends to be less fun. I mean, look, every golf course is going to have holes where, if I'm playing the same tees you guys are, that a golfer like me won't be able to reach in regulation. So to a certain extent, physical abilities are going to limit what a golfer like me can do on those courses. What I don't like is when a golf course demands consistently, hole after hole after hole, physical skills that me and plenty of other golfers don't have. Give me a way to get the ball in the hole, even if it's a goofy way, even if it's a way that might not be obvious that I have to puzzle out and really think it over. But give me an out. And that's why I think all three of us love C.B. McDonald so much, because he was sort of the grandfather of that idea, you know. Give everybody a way to get the ball in the hole and have fun. And I just, again, I think the classic courses do that so much better than many of the modern ones.
100%.
All right, so we're running up on a lot of time here. So So everybody gets through to the end. We're gonna call it. We're gonna have one last question here. So Andrew had a question for Zach, and it was, you know, regarding your favorite course in the Northeast Amateur Circuit, and I'll just open it up with John. You know, favorite kind of prestigious Northeast club outside of McDonald. We're gonna put a kibosh on McDonald and Rainer.
Oh, I don't know. Like any club in the Northeast?
Yeah, we're gonna adapt his question was for you. Your favorite course on the amateur circuit?
You know, Wanamoyset up in Rhode Island. It's the old Donald Ross course. That, I mean, the thing's on like 100 acres. It's teeny, but it's so fun, and it's really, really cool. I would say that or Sunny Hannah. That's another Tilly that's pretty good. Those are both really, really cool.
And then
I've never played the Northeast Amateur Circuit, but I'll give you a couple of my favorites real quick. It would be going south to north. It would be Somerset Hills, Sleepy Hollow, which I love, although that's a McDonald's, so cross that one off. And then up in Boston, Zach mentioned these two places earlier, and it's kind of interesting that he hasn't played them yet because he's in for a treat. My Opia Hunt Club is one of my favorite clubs anywhere, and its neighbor, Essex County Club, is also one of my favorites. Just two incredible places.
All right. Well, we'll wrap it up there. And, Zach, good luck this week, man. You know, brave.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. It's fun to talk about this. We should do it more often.
Yeah, we'll have to do some sort of like a quarterly check-in or something. See what everybody's
yeah, I like
doing.
It.
Yeah, well, and then we'll have to get the game that we talk about set up one of these days.
Yeah, we should do it at National. I think that's a good spot.
You know, I've never.
I would happily get beat by you guys at National or anywhere else for that matter. But National,
National or Somerset. I think yeah. Those are the two where we got to do it.
Yeah,
that works.
I've never been to New York, so I need to, you know, get to New York City for more than just golf. No, I've never been to New York City for anything. It's kind of crazy, actually.
Well, that'd be a good way to enter in there.
So
we'll figure it out.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, guys. It was fun, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
Yeah, you're hit it straight. This was Zach.
Thanks.